You could say there are two reigning models of journalism, and two men famous for getting the inside scoop in their own very different ways. Bob Woodward has unrivaled access to the most powerful people in Washington. By contrast, Seymour Hersh is the quintessential outsider, the reporter no one at the White House will ever talk to. Hersh is a lone wolf. He freely admits he doesn't like editors, and he has no qualms whatsoever about sticking his finger in the eye of the president. That hasn't stopped him from breaking some of the biggest stories in recent decades. In the late 60s, he uncovered the My Lai massacre, when an American army brigade slaughtered more than 500 Vietnamese villagers. Now, as an investigative reporter for The New Yorker, Hersh has uncovered another scandal, the torture at Abu Ghraib prison. Steve Paulson wanted to know how he does it.
You were one of the reporters who broke the story about Abu Ghraib. How did you get that story?
Well, you asked it so directly, I'll give you a direct answer. I got it because CBS didn't do it initially. I'd heard about the story when CBS began asking questions about it, and I applauded CBS. They had gotten photographs from somebody, I presume one of the defendants, I just don't know, in Abu Ghraib. The storyline is really simple. In the fall of 2003, panic hit us after the UN was blown up and after the Jordanian embassy was blown up, and all in August of 2003. And it was clear the insurrection was out of control or getting out of control, and it was clear we had no intelligence about it. So the idea was to find a way to toughen up our interrogation of the Iraqi detainees, the prisoners from Iraq. And unlike the prisoners from Afghanistan, most of whom were caught in the field in Afghanistan, many of the Iraqis were picked up on regular street blockades or street sweeps, you know, in downtown Baghdad. The idea was to find out more about the insurgency. And so photography of some of the people who were arrested was encouraged because there were some people we wanted to photograph and get the equivalent of blackmail information on.
Because that's the astonishing piece of this whole story is, I mean, why would they want to have these photographs taken? I mean, it's obviously so incriminating.
Because, you see, it's not because a group of kids from West Virginia reservists went crazy. It's because at one point we had a special commando unit that was around the world in the field, had been in the field by fall of last year for 18 months. After 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld authorized a secret unit to be set up. And these guys, I don't know how many, but altogether about 150 to 200 were read into the program. SEALs, Delta Force people, commandos from other the Air Force and other CMCA people perhaps were all given new identities, non-American. They were given charter planes that were chartered through private companies. They were given access to helicopters. They became sort of a ready strike team that could grow anywhere without any legal process, without rendition. Rumsfeld wanted to grab potential al-Qaeda anywhere they lived. And there was some rationale to it, of course. One of the issues being, after 9/11, we were afraid that we didn't know much about al-Qaeda. There might have been more out there. Somebody else might have been planning an attack. We wanted to get ready to preempt. And so this group was formed, and it was operating with impunity. Nobody knew much about it until Abu Ghraib, and they were sent in. Then one of the things we were doing was blackmailing Arab men. We wanted to work as a double agent, bringing them into some locale, photographing them nude, photographing them in compromising positions, telling these guys to go home to your community, join the resistance or insurgency, and spy for us, be a double agent, or else we'll spread these pictures all over your neighbors and schoolmates, etc., which in the Arab world, as we know, operates on shame. Unlike us, we operate on guilt here in the West, and so the shame would have been unbearable for a young Arab male to be photographed their way. So that was the intellectual premise. I don't know how much of that was done. All I know is it quickly morphed into the madness we saw at night, which went on for 3 or 4 months until it was reported by a soldier named Darby in January. And between January and the time CBS got another 3 or 4 months, nobody in our government, and by this time, by January, it was formally briefed. Don Rumsfeld was aware of what was going on. So was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Richard Myers, an Air Force general. So was the president. Rumsfeld said he told the president about it quickly after learning about it in January. Nobody did a thing to ameliorate or stop or just change any process. It's pretty amazing what they did. They just simply buried it.
So I want to get back to your role then. How did
Well, what happened then is the pictures eventually worked their way to CBS. And CBS investigated it and held the story. Not 1 week, but 2 weeks. And by the end of a few days, when it was clear they weren't going to run it immediately, some of the people involved who talked to CBS talked to me about it.
Some of the sources. And some of the sources in the military or in intelligence.
I just said some of the people. Let's leave it at that.
Well, I mean, that's the question. And of course, all of us who read your stories are wondering, where do you find these people? And why do they talk to you when clearly if they're working in government, their agencies are going to look horrible. They're going to look terrible because of these revelations.
Let me say something to you about that. I've been doing what amounts to an alternative history of this war since early on, which means that people like Donald Rumsfeld, with whom I had a relationship, and others, you know, this is a government, as the president said, George Bush said after 9/11, you're either with us or against us. And once it was clear I was not on the team, everybody stopped talking to me. In any case, I clearly have people in the intelligence community, the special forces community, who don't agree with the war, who clearly have been working with me, answering my questions.
But you're saying that they are basically whistleblowers. I mean, not in the public sense, if they're not going to have their names out there, but they want to get the real story out. And so they contact someone like you.
Well, or I contact them and establish a relationship that continues, even though people know that I can be pretty, you know, volatile in terms of the government's reaction to me. In any case, CBS talked to some people who talked to me. And I then proceeded to get not only the photographs, but I did something else. I got a copy of the original report by General Taguba, the very excellent report. And so I then was in a position of actually sort of wanting CBS to do the photographs because the cover-up's always a better story. And so CBS did do the story. I told people there what I knew. There's no question CBS held the story when they shouldn't have. It's a great story, and you can't understand how any newspaper or news agency would not want to be first with that story. And they were first, in a sense.
They held the story because they had been asked by the Pentagon to hold it.
Right. For 2 weeks, they held the story. And in retrospect, it does tell you sort of an awful lot of where we are. A story this volatile and this important shouldn't be held at all. Mm-hmm. And they did hold it. Then they did put it out, and they did a terrific job. And by that time, I had the Taguba report, so I could file a story that focused on the cover-up. And I also had more photographs. Altogether, I probably have seen, 70 or 80. And some are pretty ghastly.
So the public has not seen all the photographs.
You don't want to see some of them. You know, one of the decisions you make is how much humiliation do you project onto the Arabs? And how humiliated do you want them to be? You know, what was going on was horrible. You know, they were masturbating, forced to masturbate, and forced to assimilate homosexual activity with women around and cameras around. I mean, for an Arab man, as I said in the beginning, it's the worst. It's the equivalent by any definition, And I've talked to experts. It's torture.
Now, you've said that as you were starting to pursue this story, that some people in the military and intelligence and other agencies started to contact you. They wanted to get the story out. But I'm assuming that you also had to go after some sources. And do you sometimes find yourself bullying sources, saying, you know, you got to tell me this stuff or, I don't know, I'm going to make you look bad?
Well, that's sort of a cliche. That's, you know, one of the cliches, if you read all the profiles about me, is that I get on the phone and intimidate sources. I can tell you something about Washington. The people who work in Washington are very sophisticated. And the day some reporter can bully a Washington bureaucrat around is a day I haven't seen. And the fact is, it's not just bullying. It's just I tend to not write before I read. And by that I mean is I do a lot of work. And so somebody who's may have a certain set of knowledge, I can maybe talk to them and present other facts that they did not know about, and that would make them more inducive or conducive to talking to me. That's the real trick. The real trick is to know as much as possible about what you're doing, and that's very hard.
I want to ask you a bit about your experience covering the My Lai massacre, the big story that first made your name. Of course, that's the massacre where hundreds of Vietnamese civilians were killed by American soldiers. Now, I've heard that Lieutenant William Calley, the guy who was in charge of that brigade, was at the Army base in Fort Benning waiting for the court-martial proceedings to go ahead. And you just went down to the base. You started knocking on doors until you found him, and then he just opened up. He told you about all of this.
What happened is, you're right, somebody told me that some GI had shot up a lot of people in Vietnam, and he was in a different base than I was told. The charges were much greater, and he wasn't just a GI, he was an officer, which is a totally different matter. I eventually learned he was in South Carolina, in a base in South Carolina, and I went looking for him. He was hidden. Callie was hidden. And I looked and looked and looked, and finally about 1:30 in the morning, I found him hidden. He was assigned to senior officers' quarters. No second lieutenant gets assigned to the same quarters with colonels, but that's where he was assigned as a bachelor, bachelor's officers' quarters. Who could believe he would be there? And anyway, I found him, and he did talk to me. And what happened is he shot off his mouth, I guess. He said much more than he should have. Of course, his story was that his troops went in and were immediately in combat, and they fought their way, and they killed 550 Viet Cong, when in fact the death count was roughly 550 innocent women and children, 547, I think. So there was this moment after I did I spent a lot of time with him. He didn't want to let me go. I think he sort of understood I'd be the last person he was going to talk to in the press in a long time. He had a girlfriend that was a nurse, and he actually took me with him to pick her up after she did her duty, her tour of duty. His shift ended at 4 in the morning. She wasn't very happy that he brought a reporter to meet her. But we went to a local PX, a military base, or supply store, and we bought a bottle of booze and some steaks, and she made a dinner. And I remember watching him at one point. He had small quarters, and he went into the bathroom, and he sort of didn't close the door all the way. There was a mirror in the door. You could see him. He leaned over. He just went to the bathroom. He leaned over into the toilet and threw up. And we'd been drinking, and it was bright red. He clearly had a major ulcer.
Why do you think he opened up to you? Why did he tell you all that stuff?
Because I asked him. Because I found him and asked him.
But you would think that it would not be in his interest to tell a reporter this, or was he just so inexperienced?
People do things when you ask them. Americans are pretty good at that. You ask them, you find them. It's sort of basic. The irony of the upshot of the My Lai story was that his lawyer, I finally found Callie's lawyer, who had been hidden to me, and when he heard what he did, that Callie had shot off, you know, spoken as much as he did to me, Callie gave me his account of what happened that basically would have put him in jail, I think. You know, we went in there, there were people shooting at us, and it was just an impossible story. And so the lawyer said to me, he's long dead now, but George Latimer, his name was, in Salt Lake City, former judge on the Court of Military Appeals, he said, I'll make you a deal, Hirsch. I was a freelancer trying to, you know, doing this story as a freelancer with no base behind me. I'd been in the newspaper business, worked for the Associated Press. I'd been press secretary for Senator Eugene McCarthy, ran for president, but still I had no base behind me. And the judge said, if you take out the fact that you interviewed him, just make it a source close to the case said, give us that cover so we can have our trial. I'll read the story for you for accuracy. I asked him if he would. And I'll also tell anybody in the newspaper business who calls me that I've done so. So I wrote a story. He made some significant changes in it because nobody reported when you're doing, you know, you always have things wrong. By significant, I mean dates and places sometimes, but the basic facts were there. I had the story right about what was going on, but the details were very important. And then when I and a colleague, a friend of mine named David Opes, who has never been in the newspaper business but had a gift of words, began to call up newspaper editors and told them about this story. And we would send it to them by wire. And the critical thing we could say is, Callie's lawyer is such and such. Call him and he'll be glad to vouch for the story or whatever.
So you had to make the case to get newspapers to pick up the story. I mean, this amazing story.
Yes. But the thing that's amazing is that of 50 newspapers we called, I think 37 or so used the story the next morning. After talking and checking, they talked to each other. You know, the Washington Post talked to the Boston Globe, talked to the Chicago Sun-Times, to the Philadelphia Paper. All the editors talked to each other. But basically, I'm very optimistic about the news media. I think most of the trouble we have comes from self-censorship, not necessarily the oppressive management or oppressive editors. I think reporters don't do enough.
Mr. Hirsch, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure to talk with you.
Great. Thank you.
Seymour Hirsch, talking with Steve Paulson. Hirsch's new book is called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib.